League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 26th of June, 2020. On the podcast today, Russ Mould, investment director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about company fraud in light of Wirecard and going into administration, and how you can spot companies that may be fraudulent. It's not easy. Even professionals get it wrong, as we discuss. Also on the podcast, Paul Hill, full-time investor, equity analyst, gives his view on the effect the Fed are having on the market and COVID-19, and also mentions the following companies: Roslyn Data Technologies, RDT, and Alicosoft. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs. You can see both these lists, in fact, the top 10 versions of these lists, at voxmarkets.co.uk. We'll see a host, a plethora of other content, videos, articles, and our COVID-19 index. Right now, let's have a look what the biggest riser is. It's Hemogenix Pharmaceuticals, up 9.35% to 5.8 pence. And the biggest fall is N4 Pharma, down 4.8% to 3.9 pence. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Want to keep up to date with all the companies in your portfolio? On the free Vox Markets app, you can create multiple watch lists and get instant news alerts about any company you follow. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, investment director at stockbroker AJ Bell. You're right, Russ?
Very well, Justin. How are you, my friend? You okay? Good health?
Yes, I'm good, thanks. And, good. People often think you live a high-flying life. And, you sort of do, because right now, tell us about your surroundings, if you could, Russ.
Right now, I'm sat in a car showroom and garage in Horsham having my car serviced.
There you go.
It's all happening. So I'm making use of the fact that we're slowly unlocking to come and get my car looked after. It's 4 years old and it needs its service. So here I am. And to be fair to the company involved, and it's part of a quoted company, actually. Okay. They've been very accommodating. They're giving me one of their salesman's desks. And I've got my laptop, my personal Wi-Fi hotspot, my iPad, my iPhone. And I've been working away this morning doing some work on airlines and one or two other bits and pieces.
It's good, actually, because you're there. I mean, what's it like there? I mean, do they have a certain system at the moment in place?
Yeah, it's all one way in, one way out. It's all 2 meters distancing. You sanitize your hands if you haven't already as soon as you come in. There's big plexiglass at the front greetings desk and where you meet the service guy. I sanitized my hands before I handed over the keys. I left the service book, having wiped it down before I got here, on the car seat. And we're all very carefully spaced out. And if you want to come and see your car, you've got to make an appointment. You can't just roll up and they can't just let you into the showroom. So it's all very carefully controlled and very carefully managed.
Yeah, well, do you know what? We've got this sort of...
It's a Volvo showroom, by the way, if anybody's interested. There you go. Yeah, Swedish tanks.
Well, do you know what? We got this sort of two-tiered system at the moment, because I think the businesses are trying their best to be professional and doing their best to open back up in a sensible way to restrict the spread of the virus. And then trouble is, there's still a lot of people not in work. So you got them going to the beach in their thousands. And you're thinking, hang on a sec, there's the businesses trying to do the best thing, the right thing, and then there's a certain sector of the public who don't care, you know?
This is really interesting. And when I do make my forays around Brighton, there are people who they see you coming and they will instantly cross to the other side of the street. They've got a mask on, they've got gloves on, and they're clearly concerned and taking what they feel are sensible precautions. There are equally some people who are looking at their phone or just not bothered and will just walk straight through you, given half the chance.
Yeah.
So I guess it's people's individual assessment of what they're of risk and whether they think they are at risk or not, or whether they're vulnerable or not, or whether they think that the whole thing's just still no different from the 2013 flu outbreak in the UK, which took away 50,000 people and barely got a mention in the press. So you've still got very much both camps out there. Mm. I guess what's interesting is clearly one of the things that the stock, from the very narrow perspective of the stock market rather than the broader one of people's health, one of the things that stock markets are wrestling with is to what degree will people's behaviour change permanently or for a long time into the future. And we're looking at things like, will people want to go to pubs, restaurants? Will they want to travel? Will they want to stay in a hotel? Will they keep shopping online rather than going to the store? And you think, you can see why that happens. And then yesterday, there is glaring evidence of the fact that many people's behaviour will not change in any way, shape or form. Maybe in some cases, some of the things that stock markets have been frightened of just won't come to pass. And actually, in a couple of months' time, people will be just back to doing what they were doing normally. I don't know the answer, clearly on the basis of yesterday, a chunk of people who were just going to go on doing what they've done before, unless Mr. Whitty is right, and we hope he isn't, that there's potential for a fresh uptick in the number of cases.
Yeah, well, do you know what? It's I think people, we've seen this, we know this in the stock market, sentiment can change very quickly. You can think the world's going to implode, and all of a sudden you have a big rally, and then all of a sudden everyone's changed their mind, they're back, they're bullish again. I think people, even the most anxious people, I think their sentiment will change slowly. There we go. But you mentioned they have a risk, and that's a health risk, but of course, investing, it's all about risk and reward. And when you look at the risky side of the business, and people don't tend to look at that, they tend to just think about the reward they can get, then mistakes can be made, can't it? And we've seen that this week with, was it Wirecard?
It's not one that maybe everybody's heard of, the German company, but it was basically an electronic payments processor. So it was all part of the drive towards a cashless society. And it's gone from being a $28 billion company to filing for insolvency in the space of a couple of years. Yeah. And what's particularly interesting here is that a whistleblower stood up in April 2019 and said, I'm really sorry, ladies and gentlemen, I don't like what I'm seeing here. And the company trod on that and spent a lot of time trying to tread on the FT and hedge funds who were just asking questions. Yeah. So, and ultimately, the German regulator even put a short selling ban on to try and stop people getting involved. And it's turned out that in the end, the whistleblower was right, the journalists were right, the hedge funds were right, and the regulators and the company were wrong. And a lot of shareholders have dropped a boatload of dough as a result.
Yeah, yeah. Well, do you know what? A lot of people criticise short selling and all that, but sometimes it's got a function, hasn't it?
You know what? I've got no problem with it. I think there are times when I think common sense dictates the optics are terrible. You don't want to be caught short selling companies when there's a global pandemic on, for example. I think that can potentially look very bad, and I think hedge funds need to be careful. Equally, they have a duty of fiduciary duty to their clients to try and make them money. So I guess that's up to whether the clients feel comfortable with that or not. But I generally have no problem with short sellers because, one, over time, history suggests stock markets go up, so they're taking big risks. Their downside is unlimited because there is no cap on a share price, whereas their maximum payout is 100%. Because the risk reward is tricky, they really do their homework, they really ask serious questions, and they're not frightened to ask those questions. If I was a CEO, and there'll be 70 million people in the UK, I'll be delighted I'm not the CEO of a public company, but if I was the CEO of a public company, the one thing I would not do is just pull the shutters down on a hedge fund. If they turn up and go short my stock, I would personally go and see them and ask why. Mm-hmm. And then I can either explain to them why I think they're wrong, but equally, they may have seen something in the business model that I hadn't considered. And what's an hour of my time to kick ideas about with smart people? Equally, sometimes they may just say, well, we just think your shares are too expensive, in which case there's no meeting of minds, it's a valuation issue, that's fine. But they may have spotted a flaw in the business model, and, you know, heaven forbid, they certainly hope if I was running the company up, they wouldn't have spotted something fishy about the accounts. So I think what was interesting about Wirecard, some of the classic signs you've seen in previous corporate collapses, huge amounts of debt, regular restatement of the accounts, excessive reliance upon pro forma numbers or adjusted numbers, none of those things were there. The only thing that would grate a little bit was they were talked a lot about EBITDA, which, you know, I'm not a massive fan of, but, you know, and Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett, it absolutely drives them up the wall. But the only things that you could maybe say were would really give you grounds for concern was that more than 90% of EBITDA came from Asia, and particularly the Philippines. So any company that's got big concentration risk in any product, area or customer, you're always taking an extra risk anyway. So that was one thing that stood out. But I think what's startling in Wirecard's case is there's 1.9 billion euros that, first of all, the company said it couldn't find, and now it said it may not have existed in the first place. Yeah. So if this is a fraud, it shows how very hard it is for shareholders, because if somebody's determined enough, as I guess we found out potentially in the case of Patisserie Valerie, then, you know, it's very hard to spot. But there are things that you can look for, one of which is if companies do bang on about pro forma a lot, you need to ask yourself why. If they restate the accounts a lot, you need to ask yourself why. Always be careful of multiple acquisitions, be careful of lots of debt. And even if they didn't apply to Wirecard, they will get you out of trouble. And the other one, a big friend of mine, a guy called Mike Cahill, who's a former analyst like myself at UBS, at Warburg's, and he always used to love the rule of three. And he would run a little simple spreadsheet over 5-10 years, and he would compare sales growth with growth in operating profit, with growth in free cash flow. And free cash flow would be operating profit plus depreciation amortization minus interest minus tax minus net working capital minus capex. And generally, all right, they won't all move exactly the same percentage, but he said you always want to see them moving in the same direction. So if you have a company that shows strong sales growth and strong profit growth, but for a couple of years the cash flow doesn't grow or even shrinks, he says you've got a question. There could be legitimate reasons for it, but there might not be. And I think one of the things that the regulators are now investing in the case of Wirecard is, was the company showing trade receivables, i.e. business for which it hasn't been yet paid, as cash? So business, cash it was due but hadn't received, was it showing those as cash? Because the auditors clearly had the wool pulled over their eyes somehow. But if the cash flow doesn't flow and grow at the same, go in the same direction as profits and sales, you've at least got some very, very serious questions to answer. And if you look at previous big frauds in Europe, like, say, Parmalat, which was a milk, Italian milk company, where basically somebody forged a bank account to say it had 4 billion euros with Bank of America. Belgian speech business Learnout and Howspeed, it turned out the technology didn't work, but by then Microsoft had bought it, so tough luck. Spanish Wi-Fi provider Let's Go X and Spanish conglomerate Steinhoff, they were just systematically somebody internally doing their best to obfuscate. So there's very little you can do as an external shell to protect yourself other than check out the accounts. And there were probably one or two signs there. Other cases like Luckin Coffee recently in China, again, there was just a chief operating officer was just fabricating the numbers. In other ones, I guess Steinhoff was, there was glaring amounts of debt and they were acquisitive, which would naturally be a warning sign. You haven't seen big ones in the US for over 20 years now, since Tyco, WorldCom and Enron. I think Sarbanes-Oxley has made it a lot harder, but equally now in the US with pro forma non-GAAP numbers, I do wonder things that might get more interesting. And I think generally these things come out when times are difficult, which, let's face it, times are not normal right now and are difficult for a lot of people and a lot of companies. And it's generally a fairly top of the cycle thing, because the executives are looking to make money, cash out, whatever, and get out with their reputations and money intact. And generally it's harder to conceal these things when things start going wrong, because, you know, the economy is getting tougher. J.K. Galbraith actually called this the bezel. If you read his 1955 book, The Great Crash, he actually talks about the bezel and how it's a cyclical thing, and people get less diligent in their accounts when things are going well, because they're making money and everybody's getting happy. So what's the problem? And then during bear markets, everybody gets really tight, the audits get tighter, and that's when the trouble occurs. So I would suspect if we get a long recession, you might find a few more tricky things coming out of the closet. So again, the thing to focus on always is cash flow. And the other way to protect yourself is valuation. Mm-hmm. You know, and why can't have a huge valuation, big multiples of earnings and cash flow and sales. And so your downside protection, if anything went wrong, was low. Now, in this case, okay, it's an extreme one. They're filing for insolvency and shareholders will be completely wiped out. And again, that's what you need to remember as a shareholder. You look at the list of creditors. If a company goes bust, you're at the bottom. So you will get 0 pence in the pound on your investment back. If you're a lender to the company, you will get so many pence in the pound back. And the more senior you are, the bigger your slice of the pie. And so that's the one thing you always need to bear in mind as a shareholder. You are to, yes, you're getting potentially the biggest upside through the share price, but you're also potentially getting the biggest downside, because if things go wrong, it's going to go to nil.
Yeah, do you know what's interesting about this? Is like, it just shows, even, you know, this is why a lot of people don't go into investing themselves, they rely on professionals, and even professionals don't spot these kind of things, you know? So it's hard, because like I said, that you talk about cash flows and operating margins and all this, and profit and loss accounts, and, so, you know, a lot of private investors may have not any knowledge of that whatsoever, you know? They look at the profit, P&L sheet, and that's it. They don't understand of cash flow, so... And also, it generally happens with companies doing very well, doesn't it? They're almost doing too well, and if it's too good to be true, sometimes they're covering
there
up.
There's the secret.
And certainly, I mean, the only way you can protect yourself as a private investor against this kind of thing is, again, diversification. If you, say, limit yourself to exposure of like 10% of one stock, then if one goes through, the worst that can happen is 10%, you know? And
correct.
It's always tricky, isn't it, you know?
It is. I think the too good to be true rule is a great one.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there were very few clues with Patisserie Valerie.
Yeah.
The only one was it was making much bigger margins than Starbucks and Whitbread that were doing the same thing.
Yeah. And so Luckin Coffee as well was doing very well, wasn't it?
There you are. They were just making much bigger margins than Starbucks. So if you were to look at a coffee and cake company and it's making a margin that's miles bigger than Starbucks, you better really ask yourself, why is that? Because it might not be for necessarily a good reason. So I think, too good to be true is always a good test. And let's face it, you don't need to have to own any stock. I know we all get frightened of missing out, but you don't have to own anything. You have the option. You're not an index tracker. If you don't like something, you don't understand something, walk away. It's probably the safest thing. Yes, you may have a bit of non-buyer's regret, but your regrets could be an awful lot bigger if you own something and it goes down 100%.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you know what? It's funny, I'm watching, I don't know if you've watched it on Netflix, called Ozark. It's about this guy who's an accountant, and he ends up kind of mixed up with the mafia.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah, mafia is very good, yeah. And but he talks his way through how to launder cash, and he said, basically, you can't launder too much through businesses, because if the margins get too big, you get investigated. So you have to be within a margin of error of that business. Look at the peers, and he starts laundering money through a strip club. He said, it can't do it excellently well, because if it does, people say, well, how come you're doing so well compared to the rest of strip clubs in this county, you know? So it's always at that level. If someone's doing too well, it can be a red flag. Of course it can happen, but it's amazing that you mentioned that company there, that tech company. Even Microsoft got duped by them, and they're a tech company,
They bought Learnout and Housebee for billions of dollars, and it proved to be worth nothing.
Yeah, so if they can't spot it, you know, it comes down again, diversification a little bit, doesn't it? That's all
Correct.
You can do. You know, limit your risk.
Correct.
Of course, your reward will be limited, but that's the price you pay for not having one, you know, completely crater on you, I suppose. But
Correct.
There we are. Marvellous stuff, Russ. I saw your preparations for cricket recently. It was a lot of hand sanitizer involved, and so...
Yes. Ridiculously, I help coach at my son's under the club at my son's under 11 team, and I do all the admin as well, which is a tricky task. But we were due to play our first ring session. It's only five boys and one coach.
Yeah,
and we were due to train for the first time on Sunday, and it rained.
Oh,
which, given the heat wave that we've had, is just enough to make a vicar kick a hole in the stained glass window, as Raymond Chandler once said. So I rearranged that session for last night, and it was obviously nearly 30 degrees, but I had hand sanitizer, Dettol, hand wipes, suntan lotion, paper towels, gloves. So all precautions taken again. Keep the boys at a 2 meter distance. Nobody's allowed to pick up the ball. They had to use their own ball. So extra things for me to think about, as well as all the normal safety drills. And in the end, make sure the boys help the boys enjoy their cricket and just get back in the swing of playing sport again. And all the parents were delighted that they were out and about, rousting about, not playing Fortnite.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. Fortnite, God, it's literally, my kids don't want a life outside Fortnite. It's literally, if they're not watching Fortnite guys on YouTube, they're trying to get them on Fortnite. I have to limit them, get them to do other things, but
Exactly. We ration it very strictly, and it's just, come on, we're off for a walk, we're off for a bike ride, we're going to go have some practice, but you know, whatever it is, it's, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I just keep thinking, I wish I'd been given the opportunity to invest in this early stage, you know. So it's like, well, it's completely amazing. Anyway, Russ, have a nice weekend, fella.
Keep well.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Hill, equity analyst and full-time investor. You're right, fella.
Yeah, morning, Justin.
What's the week? Do you know what's fascinating, actually? Every Friday, I look at the Fed balance sheet on the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, and it's gone down the last couple of weeks, pretty much. They've reined in. And it's odd. The S&P and the Nasdaq peaked pretty much on the peak of the Fed spend, which I don't think that's a coincidence. You know, it just shows new the liquidity in the markets at the moment, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there certainly has been a sort of like a, you know, historically quite a high correlation between what the Fed is pumping into the market and the actual performance of the S&P. However, I would say that there are other things actually, you know, sort of dragging the S&P or down at the moment, or at least holding it back. And that's, you know, the opening up of the states, and they've had a sort of like an increase in the number of infections. I mean, that's the more logical conclusion. I mean, you just got to look at the beaches, even in Bournemouth yesterday, had lots of people. So people are getting a bit more sort of like cautious in terms of how we all know we're going to get a second wave. It just depends on how big and whether it's manageable. And so the answer to that question is, even if it's as big as the first, we're going to get through it. And if it's another 50% on top, we're still going to get through it. And why do I say that? The medical science is much better. We have remdesivir, but look at the the steroid that we had the other day, dexamethasone. I mean, that reduces the number of fatalities if somebody's on a ventilator by 30%, so you can, that reduces your fatality rate. And as I say, the key number to look at is not one, IR1, it's 1.7, and if it's 1.7 or below, it means the herd immunity is reached around about 44% or 40%. And in that basis, if we've done 15%, if we have 10% of people who are asymptomatic, another 10% have already had the disease by the end of August, that's 20%. If we get another 15%, which is about 10 million people, we will have less fatalities than we had in the first round, which politically is going to be acceptable. 10% plus 20% is 30%. It means the third wave is a non-event, and therefore we're there. So, you know...
Did you know this? This is a fact. It's quite interesting, I think. Humans have never built up herd immunity to a coronavirus.
Why is that amazing? I think everybody knows that, don't we?
Well, because everyone talks about herd immunity. We've never had it. We've never achieved it, ever.
Well, we've got... No, we get herd immunity two ways, yeah? For infectious diseases. You get it through vaccines, which is mostly... That's why you have an MRI jab,
No, not for coronavirus. Even the flu. Like I said, every year it mutates. We need a new virus, a new vaccine, which is... So with this one, and I was watching... In fact, it's, I don't know if you've got... Netflix is an explained thing on there, very coronavirus explained. And they were saying that... We know everyone's thinking that the vaccine is the big thing, and it is the big thing, of course. I mean, AstraZeneca now confident, and a couple of other people of authority are quite confident of having a vaccine before the end of the year, which is very good. Now, that will last, they're saying, hopefully for 12 months. You know, that's not for everyone, of
course.
Agreed,
yeah.
Not for everyone. But it's not only that. This lady came on then and said, she was from one of the companies looking for a vaccine. A company has never produced a billion vaccines like that in one go. It's never been done. So we got, you know, if you're talking about 60% of this thing, if you want to get a herd immunity via this vaccine, temporary herd immunity, that is, 60% of the world, that even the production of that, the manufacturing, and Bill Gates said, no, we can't even produce the glass bottles in that quantity, let alone the vaccine. Okay, so that is phenomenal.
Did you watch that report this week, which was said that there's a 1 litre bottle does 2 million doses, which they're doing for synthesize. Currently, vaccines are having to be made because they're live, they're proteins, and you know it's actually made from organic material. But if you can synthesize it like a normal pill, like an aspirin, then you can make this on a huge amount of scale.
That's never been done. So we are breaking all kinds of records here, just speed to the thing. So we're all assuming it can be done, but there's a lot of assumptions going on here because, like I said, it's a massive thing to deal with. But like I said, luckily, this, as we know now, the more we get on, we know more about it. It's only sort of like I said, if you are below 60, you're healthy pretty much, you're sort of confined. It could have been a lot worse, couldn't it? You know, it could have affected everyone.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we've as a nation, as a world, we've got better at actually adapting, to social distancing, other than obviously, say, Bournemouth Beach.
I know, that's insane. Why? I hate crowds anyway, let alone when there's a pandemic around. Why do people want to go down there? I prefer to go anywhere apart from where crowds are, you know?
You should go to a football match then, in that case, at the moment, because it's empty.
I hate crowds. I generally hate people anyway, generally, you know. So, go on.
Yeah, but I think that basically macro-wise, I've got, even though we're sort of like consolidating at the moment at the top level, I've got no worries. I'm still sort of like biased towards the positives, and I think we're going to get through the second wave. The economy's going to slowly, reopen. There's still some challenged areas. Airlines are obviously a problem. Restaurants is going to be a lot of insolvencies. Likewise in the hotels. I mean, it's going to take time for the capacity to come back, and it all depends on.
Do you know what? I heard a guy on Radio 5 Live, Wake Up the Money this morning, and he took an EasyJet flight, I think yesterday, and he said it was horrible. I said, what do you mean? He said, it basically, from the time you go in the airport, you put a mask on, you've got to put the mask on there, you've got social distance, there's queues a lot longer than normal, even there's less in the queue, of course, there's more waiting time, and you get on the plane, you're not going to take the mask off. He said, I did it in internal flight. And he said, by the time I got out the airport at the other end, I just wanted to get that mask off, so uncomfortable, so claustrophobic. It was nasty and horrible experience. And so I'm thinking, you imagine, I'm booked to go on a Dominican Republic, I think, at the end of the year. Imagine wearing a mask for 10 hours. I can't imagine that. I hate flying anyway. So I'm just thinking, mess up the sort of experience.
Yeah, well, you imagine having a nice romantic meal with your wife to celebrate your anniversary with masks on.
I often do that. The leather. she'd probably
put one on you, wouldn't she?
I know. So it's going to change the experience a lot. A lot is going to change. Well, the contagion has to come down massively before you take the masks off and make it acceptable again, because that is a completely different experience, isn't it,
Oh, it is, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't go out. There's no doubt about it. Would I go to a pub with a mask on? No. Would I actually, because just the experience just isn't there. And I certainly wouldn't spend a lot of money on a nice romantic meal with a mask on. I mean, why am I going to do that? But there will be a lot of people who do. And there might be instances where we don't need masks if you're dining outside. So they're going to get some business back. But it's a challenged area. And so I personally would be staying well clear in investment perspective of these areas like, say airlines, restaurants, pubs, the mining sector, anywhere whereby they're going to have extra costs and they're not going to get back to capacity anytime soon.
Yeah. I've seen, oddly, it's on the funny days that like Carnival Cruises and EasyJet, they tend to rally on the days when almost the COVID stocks rally. It's like when people have this fake hope and then when we have people who are going back to normal, we get normal stocks that can do quite well or do okay, shops tend to rally. It's a really odd situation. Anyway, listen, I know one of the companies you talked about a lot, Roslyn Data, released some good news this week, didn't they? Contract renewals.
It was great.
Talk us through this if you could.
Yeah, I mean, basically, they extended three customer contracts with an average, it's basically an annualized revenue of 0.9 million with a total value of 1.5. And the key bit is, I mean, the sales roughly for the business are ARRs roughly around about 6 mil. So if you're sort of renewing a sixth of that, that's reasonably significant. Total sales are around about sort of like, I think it's about 7.5 mil for this year. So it is significant. But more so, what it it's saying is that the customers actually want to actually buy their products. And now you say, why do they? Well, this is because they're in the sweet spot. And we've talked about this before. Because as you come out of COVID, it's going to have two things. One is going to be transitory, i.e. things that we're going to finish. But a lot of it's going to be transformational. And if you're a corporate, a large corporate, you want to do two things. You know, first of all, you want to make sure you've got, you know, your supply chain is all sorted, and you want to reduce costs, which it obviously does. And then you want to sort of like, you know, maximize the data you have. And so, you know, moving to the cloud, and these guys are right in all that sweet spot. And so they're getting, you know, I haven't spoken to them in terms of, you know, sort of like all the other opportunities they have. But I just think this is indicative of, you've got their type of customers now realizing they need help from businesses like Rosslyn, and I think the direction of travel is going to be strong. As I say, I'm a long-term investor. I will hold for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, very, very comfortably. They're good contract wins, more, you know, good endorsements, and I can see. I mean, the board has actually got a strategic target, to triple revenues over the next sort of 3 years, and if they do that, then the shares will be anywhere between sort of 15p and 25p, and that will be modest, as in like, you know, using a modest valuation, because big data type businesses go for a lot higher, and you know, they're right in that sweet spot, and their customer list is fantastic. So yeah, I think it's very positive. SaaS, you know, type SaaS revenue, software, large drop through rate. I mean, it just really sort of underpins why, when they did their £7.3 million placing, they did it at 22% premium to the 20-day average, you know, previous day average. So yeah, it just says to me there's opportunity there. I mean, it's small cap, so there's risk and a few volatility, but I'm happy to sort of accept that level of risk and hold for the long term.
Yeah, and do you know what? It's like I read that RNS, and I thought it's nice that the end clients are an international telecoms business, a world-renowned American university, and UK government department. So they're not just a local one-man-in-his-band outfits, you know. And not only that, it's like everyone wants, for a long time, for a while, when SaaS came in, people didn't understand the values, and then they sort of realised, well, hang on, so you've got companies fully prepared to accept a lower revenue as long as it was recurring, because you understand why. Because if you've got a business, let's be honest, and in these uncertain times, and you can guarantee that pretty much 80% of this year's revenue is guaranteed next year as well, then that's ideal, isn't it? You know, it's there.
Oh yeah, it's perfect.
And all you need to do is expand on that. Then, so, but already you're starting next year, and you've got a big chunk of revenue. You know, the majority of revenue is already guaranteed coming through the books. You know, and it's already in the bank. Yeah. I mean, that's perfect.
That's right. And the value and the return that the client makes is enormous compared to the cost that they have to do for implementing this, and you know, spend. Yeah. So you know, the return on economics for these guys when they want to reduce their cost base and streamline their, you know, supply chains is just enormous, and that's why they're turning to these guys.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, let's be honest. Let's say you said their revenue, total revenue, is about seven and a half million. Let's say it's 8 million, for example. And let's say you've got another company that's 10 million. But at the end of this year, that company with 10 million has to start again. Now, building that up to 10 million again is hard work in this environment. But if you've got, like, you know, say 6 million coming in next year already, and you're starting off at 6 million. That's where you want to be, isn't it? You don't want to have to start again fighting for new contracts on a yearly basis. You want recurring, you know, annual revenue, and that's perfect, isn't it, really?
Yeah. So, yeah, no, absolutely delighted, yeah.
Cool. Ardy, listen, I saw you talking about, I don't know, having a bit of a to and fro, a bit of a discussion on Twitter with someone who's, I don't know, faceless, nameless. Do you know what I always say to people? Not everyone on Twitter without a name and a face is a troll, but all the people who troll me and nasty to me never have a name and a face on their Twitter account. They always hide behind a graphic or a cartoon and a different name. And I just say, generally, when people start having a go at me, I say, listen, do me a favour, put your real name and your real face on your Twitter ID. Then we'll have a discussion. Because people tend to take on a different persona when they hide behind, you know, an avatar. And I just think, so I had someone sort of discussing with Elko. What happened there, Elecosoft?
I mean, basically, I don't know that much about it other than this report, a 114-page supposed research report was published yesterday by CipherSense, which is a new research house which was created on Twitter in May, so it isn't very old, okay? And they spent a month producing this report, which I think was then taken by Tom Winifred of Share Profits, who's then publicised, and that's why the shares yesterday went down. Now, I try to politely, as you rightly say, engage with this CypherSense research house to understand who it actually is behind it. And they refused, even though I kindly asked them about three times and hid behind sort of like smoke and mirrors. And I thought, this is obviously a bit strange. And then when you actually download the report, this tombstone, and you look at they've left the name on the author. So I'm assuming it's a guy. The guy is on the author is a guy called Dexter Burt. Now, I've never heard of this guy, and I don't. And if anybody who's listening to this has, then let me know. However, he has an uncannily resemblance of some people I've come across on ADFN, who has also been trolling Ilecosoft there from in a different pseudonym. Now I really haven't got a clue whether Dexter is these other guys, but he's obviously got a bee in the bonnet about Ilecosoft. I'm pretty relaxed because I've kicked the tires on this business. I bought about two or three years ago. I've only added over that period. I've not sold a single share. I'm very, very comfortable with the strengths of the business. Again, it's improving client productivity, improving their services. It's growing. It's highly cash generative, and the profits are going up. So I've got absolutely no problem, and it's reasonably priced. So. A lot of the claims in there, I haven't even read the report, to be rude, because what I try and do before spending 3 days trying to read through a 114-page report, is just to try and understand the background and the motivations of why the person's done it. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether he's short the product. I don't think he is. He just wanted sort of like, for other people to read his reports and get a bit of stuff. I really don't know. Or is he really trying to do, Carson Block does at Muddy Waters and try and take aggressive positions on the south. So I really don't know what his motivations, but as I say, I'm totally relaxed on this one. The shares are starting to increase today. I actually think it was a buying opportunity yesterday, that's my personal view. I don't know if you've ever heard of this guy Dexter Burr.
I'm always suspicious though of people who don't I don't understand why people cover up their name and their face. I'll be honest, if you're going to be transparent about a business, if you want people to trust you and your judgment on something, then just put yourself out there. What's the problem?
There is a guy on LinkedIn, and again, I really don't know, it's only connection, it could just be coincidence. There is a guy on LinkedIn called Dexter Burt, okay? Mm. And he's an accountant who's based in Reading, according to his account, who knows he's got a connection with Tom Winifred. So putting two and two together, I mean, it may be wrong, but putting two together, it's that guy. And I've reached out to him to have a chat, but he won't talk to me. And on that basis, I it's difficult for me to assess whether what he's talking about, what's his motivations. If he wanted to actually have a proper, conversation, I'd talk to him. But he just basically just refuses.
I don't understand that. What was the general gist of it? Was he saying it's overvalued? What was the problem? Was there something wrong with it? What's the issue?
He's got a whole bunch of different issues. He's just been throwing mud at just about everything. He just doesn't like it. He's done the same. I'm sure it's the same guy. He's done the same on ADFN for a long time. He's contacted me before, and he won't. And again, he's refused to disclose his name, even though he knows me well. And he's happy to have pot shots at me, and he's happy to have pot shots at everybody else, including the company. And apparently, if it is the same guy, he's had pot shots at lots of other companies as well. I don't know what he's motivated. I really don't mind. That's what gets him going. He just let him get going. If he enjoys doing it, that's fine. I mean, he must have wasted a flipping month writing this report. But if you have a look at it,
I can't see
it.
Why would you spend that long doing that unless you have something to gain from it? I don't understand.
It may be publicity. He could be short. He could be short. I really don't know. But
no one's going to read that document.
I'd
say most private investors, haven't got enough time to, read an RNS that's on another page.
Pages. I know. Yeah, so, exactly. But 114 pages. And then, as I say, not to put your name to it and stand by the contents and your disclosures just doesn't smell right, and then refuse to even disclose. I mean, he may decide actually now, once you've chatted about it, actually I do need to put my face to the name. And if he does, I'll credit to the guy, and I'll have a chat to him. But I'm not going to waste my time flying around, you know, spending a lot of time going through it in granular detail. When somebody's just, I mean, who knows, as in like what his motivations are? I don't know. If anybody finds out why this guy, Dexter Burt, if it is him who's wrote it, but he's the author of the document, apparently. If anybody knows this guy, I'd just drop me something on Twitter or LinkedIn or something like that, because I'd be interested. But hey, it's up to him. He can do whatever he likes, really. That's the beauty of the UK. It's a democracy.
Yeah, exactly. And as I say, sometimes it's... provides another side to the research if someone wants to look at that side. There we go.
Yeah, but I think genuinely, it was a buying opportunity yesterday. I think those shares will recover over the next month. I've got really no. I mean, so if you've got a business that's growing, it's profit high profit margins and cash generative, isn't that what you? And it's software and largely software as a service. We just talked about it. Isn't that what you were looking for?
yeah, exactly. I largely whenever. So, did he get personal with you or not?
He's been personal quite a few times. Always been very polite.
Yeah.
I've always asked him what his name is and what's his motivations. And he's just every single time, he's just blanked me and just said, no. And I just think, okay, well, if you're not prepared to do that, I'm sorry, I'm not wasting any more time on you.
Yeah. Once someone gets personal, I just block. No point for that.
Exactly.
I have a discussion, fine. But if you're going to get personal, it shows me they've lost.
he's got something. If it is this Dexter guy and what he says on his LinkedIn, he's an accountant. He's not stupid. He's obviously got a brain, but he's just acting like, I don't know. It's strange, very strange. But hey, I'm not losing any sleep on it. I'm comfortable with the stock. I'm very happy with it.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Marvelous stuff. And by the way, one other thing, if you, like I said, you are an equity analyst and you look at stocks or some of that, you've won some, you've lost some. Of course, we always learn more when we lose, I tend to think. So experience helps, but someone, we discussed this on Twitter. If someone wants to ask you any questions, how you find companies, what you look for, what you're trying to avoid, by all means, send Paul or me an email on Twitter or on here or whatever, however you want to get in contact.
Yeah, please do, guys.
And, we'll cover it in some way. Because sometimes...
Yeah.
Do you know what? I was just talking with Russ Mull before you came on about, Wirecard and fraud. And it's such a complex area. Even professionals, cannot spot fraud sometimes. In fact, a lot of professionals don't. They get caught out. And so it's a hard game. It really is a hard game. But there are certain things you should try and avoid, I think.
I mean, one thing I would say, just in terms of that, is the... Now, I know this is a strange expression, but the fraud cycle, tends to lag the economic cycle by about 3 to 6 months. Because what happens is this: is when you have a downturn, then it sort of like exposes a number of people, a number of positions, fraudsters, etc. And people want their money back. And if you look back at sort of like what happened at the dot-com boom, when we had the dot-com crash, Enron and WorldCom had problems. When you look at sort of like, the financial crisis, Bernie Madoff suddenly appeared because he had to redeem. And now you're getting it this time again. So all I would say is...
Same as Russ said that. He said, do you know what? You tend to get a lot of these things in a downturn. When the downturn starts happening, if you drag on, you'll probably get more frauds coming to light. Because, like you say, there's more pressure from people wanting their money back. They can't get the money back. Unveils the fraud. Yeah, that happens a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I would say a red flag for it is if there's stuff in their balance sheet with working capital, because they're taking sales and profit, but accelerate. What they do is they either inflate debtors because they take sales early, or another thing they do is inflate, they call basically current assets, and that's sort of like, work in progress and stuff. And once you start seeing a huge sort of like, mismatch in terms of the balance sheet movements compared to, say, competitors, then that's an absolute red flag. Yeah. And another thing to watch out for, which has been increasingly used, is what they call reverse factoring. Mm-hmm. And that's where essentially it's off balance sheet finance that suddenly appears because the auditors won't sign it off this time, and that's what a large part of that's what's brought NMC down, the healthcare business, mm-hmm. Out in the Middle East. So there's a number of sort of red flags to watch for, but the balance sheet usually tells the story to me.
Well, do you know one of the things Russ said, his friend of his used to do, he says basically, if sales and cash flows, three bits he looked at, if sales are increasing and profit is increasing and cash flow is increasing altogether, not exactly the same, but you know, in a good steady state together, it's okay. If cash flow is really down and the profits are really up, then there's something you should always question that. That shouldn't be happening. If it consistently happens, you know, they're always like the cash flow seems to be low and the profits are massive, then sales are massive, then there's something going wrong there, you know. So it's always worth looking at. It's always tricky. I mean, I always think though, it all generally happens in companies like you say, Bernie Madoff and all that, and in particularly Valerie, companies are doing better than they you know, doing very well than their peers. Mm. Their margins are better, their sales are better. You know, it's almost too good to be true, you know.
Oh, yeah, you get that all the time, and you get people sort of like, you know, pumping the stock up and all that kind of stuff just on the back of it. So, yeah, you just got to be careful. But I would say if you look at the hard, you know, hard and fat numbers, then and more importantly, actually, look at the notes, because there's lots of things in the notes that just like just totally flag it out, and you just say, well, okay, that's just like bizarre. I mean,
though, you know that because it comes from experience. Because if someone, you know, most private investors probably don't delve that deeply into, you know, cash flow, the notes of a financial statement, and even if they did, they wouldn't know what's awry. You know, it's only through experience you know that shouldn't be there. That's a bit unusual. You know, so it's experience, really, isn't it? You know.
Oh, it can be, yeah. I mean, there was one company a few years back, which was well, that was two companies. There was Globo, which had a huge amount of debtors that inflated all their sales. Another one was Silverdale, which again, equally went bust because it inflated all its current assets. Mm-hmm. And then you just sort of say, this is just not on, you know. And the other thing I would, you know, any business, and this may be not due to fraud at all, but just any business that has a really heavy working capital cycle, i.e. such that if you add one pound of additional or incremental revenue to the top line and it requires £1.50 or £2 of additional working capital to be added, and there's a few of those businesses around, I would just like forget that's a barge pole, just stay well clear, because it means if you're expanding you're also consuming cash and you'll never see the returns, you never get a dividend, and you just don't go anywhere near it, because something's really if it isn't something that is poor accounting or aggressive accounting practice, it's just a very poor business model. Either way, you want to stay well clear.
Yeah, exactly. So when you were going to say, look at the balance sheet, you're saying debtors, you know, trade and other receivables, what, you're saying that's going to be very high, you say?
Or yes, compared it would to last be, yeah, year? Yeah.
I mean, you get... what are you comparing it to? Say, let's say, for example, I compared to what, so, you know, what high compared to what other metric?
Okay, well, if you operate a normal business in the Western world, you're probably going to have debtor days of roughly around about sort of 45 to 60. So, you get paid, if you invoice in the month, you get paid the following month and on average. So, 45 to 60 days. In Asia, it's a bit longer. So, but you shouldn't have, if you're a global business, shouldn't have more than, even if you're sort of, you know, a Unilever or somebody like that with big Asian, you know, like they've got heavy in India and stuff, you shouldn't have debtor days of more than 60 days or 70 days. Some firms, you come across, particularly technology business just based in Asia or even in the Middle East, etc., they can have debtor days of over a year. You look at it and you think, there's something strange there. It just smacks out as just like, this is just impossible. You know, something's going really weird there. And so, yeah, debtor days is absolutely key. And then I would also say the split in there, things like current liabilities, dig into that, because you're paying your suppliers, but also you've got that's where they tend to hide things like reverse factoring and stuff, i.e. they'll have other payables and other accruals and all this sort of stuff. And frankly, it's just another name for long-term debt, which they're not publicising, you know, and that's what happened with NMC.
Marvellous stuff. Cool. And in the end of you know, the final sort of barrier, I suppose, is always diversify. Don't chuck everything in one basket, I suppose. So you know, that way, even if one goes through, if you've only got 10% exposure to it, you know, that's the biggest damage you can do to your portfolio. The problem happens when people see a company doing very well, they chuck everything into it. And then you realise it's a fraud. And then, wow, oh no.
Oh, yeah, I know, yeah. But it happens to all of us, let's be clear about it. You know, even the brightest. And when you look at Bernie Madoff, the amount of very, very sophisticated investors he drew in and fleeced. I mean, he lost basically $12 billion. Yeah. And, you know, the people like you know, Nicola Horlick and people like that, I mean, they were wiped clean. So, You know, it isn't. Don't think you're going to be immune. And that's, you know, it comes down to your comment, Isaac, to the diversifier, because you can take all the precautions and still be just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, do you know what? A good example, just finally, Russ gave an example of Microsoft buying a Belgium tech company. Their tech didn't even work because of their fraud. So if Microsoft, which is a tech company, buy a tech company and they can't do due diligence on that tech company, you can realise anyone can get caught up in it.
Yeah, I know. You know. I mean, I worked at Marconi back in the dot-com booms, mm-hmm. and I remember there was a guy called John Mayer who was the CEO at the time. He was on a massive, great, big M&A sort of like extravaganza. And I was speaking to the corporate finance guy there, who was actually now the finance director of a Volex. And he was effectively instructed by John Mayo to buy this business out in the West Coast, I think it was Seattle. And they paid about $375 million for it, yeah? Mm. 3 months later, they wrote it off to zero. $375 million they wrote off to zero.
I know, it's nuts, isn't it? I know, even at that level, you think, good God, wasn't anyone doing basic checks? You know,
so, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So,
cool, marvellous stuff. So, any questions, get them to me or Paul, and we'll cover them next week on the Ask Paul section. You have a little jingle. I want you to make up your own jingle. Ask Paul!
Sounds good, Justin. See you next week.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. At five, it's UK Oil and Gas, 1.4% up to 0.36 pence. At four, Sealand Capital Galaxy Limited. That was up like 200% yesterday because they've done a deal with Tencent, which is, of course, the media conglomerate in China. At three, ADM Energy, up 10% to 4.25 pence. At two, Into Properties, down 59%. Why people are following those for the bounce trade, I suppose, but haven't they announced they're going into the administration? And at one, Deltic Energy, of course, which used to be called Clough Natural Resources. I had Graham Swindells, the CEO, on the podcast yesterday discussing that and why they changed the name. These are the top five most liked R-Orneses. Sorry, R-Neses. Not R-Orneses. At five, Starcom posting annual report, notice of AGM. At four, Asia Met Resources, corporate update. At three, Tesco, one Q1 trading statement. At two, Hemogenics development agreement, autoimmune disease treatments. And at one, Hummingbird Resources, signing of SPA for Carusa and exploration update. That's it for the podcast, by the way. Are they up? No, they're down a smidge, down just under 1%. 29.25 pence, Hummingbird. But that's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciate.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.